today on Against the Grain. They struggled for public housing, for public transport, and to reduce the police force. They fought to have access to public space, so cities weren't just the playground of the wealthy. More than a century ago, workers battled for the public infrastructure that we take for granted as part of a larger struggle for socialism. Historian Shelton Stromquist discusses how we live in those socialist cities today, which elites are trying to return to private hands. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When national politics are headed further to the right, can cities serve as a battleground for broadening what is held in common, for public abundance over private wealth? The advocates of municipal socialism believe that cities were key to transforming society for the better, a movement that spanned the globe and culminated in the socialist city of Red Vienna. My guest, Shelton Stromquist, is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa. In his substantial survey, Claiming the City, A Global History of Workers' Fight for Municipal Socialism, Stromquist looks at the many forms that such efforts took, from Paris till Milwaukee. Shelton, how have elites historically organized cities to benefit themselves, to benefit the propertied and the wealthy?
Historically, cities have been the site of trade and accumulation of property. And the elites who regulated and controlled that trade have had a strong interest in defending the conditions of their economic interests, and, you know, finding ways to allow cities to grow, but to grow in ways that aren't going to undermine or threaten their property. So this elite pattern of elite governance, which, you know, goes back to the earliest days of cities, was by the latter parts of the 19th century quite deeply entrenched. Although challenged from time to time by popular mobilization around grievances that became increasingly pressing, these elites were able to maintain their control of the governance of cities pretty much without fundamental challenge. Now, the composition of these elites changed over time, and by the era of industrialization, kind of new elites began, who were less based in trade and more in manufacturing, began to assert their interests, and they became in the early to mid 19th century in England, Germany, and in the U.S. as well, kind of major players in kind of reconstituting the system of governance in cities without fundamentally challenging the so-called rights of property. So these reforms essentially continued to shut out popular democratic participation in the governance of cities, but did so in ways that empowered kind of new and emerging elites, and to some degree, an emerging middle class.
Well, perhaps the most famous instance of working class people wresting control of the city out of the hands of elites and trying to organize it themselves for themselves was the Paris Commune of 1871, which was to then inspire generations to come. Can you remind us of what the Paris Commune was, and talk about its significance politically in providing a sense of the possible to labor activists, to working class people, to socialists afterwards?
As you know, I really describe and kind of set out the Paris Commune at the outset of my book because it did become a kind of legendary moment in which, in a more explicit and briefly successful way, working class people asserted their rights to the city, to having a voice and to using that voice to amend the conditions that they confronted in urban life. So the Paris Commune is often remembered as an insurrection. And in some ways it was, although in its earliest stages, it really was a kind of bloodless revolution in which, under the circumstances of France's defeat at the hands of Prussia in 1871, the ruling class in metropolitan Paris had essentially retreated from the city. And in this new political space, a kind of emergent popular movement established itself and claimed the right to govern the city. These were kind of unique historical circumstances that created this space that in some ways was quite unanticipated, although Paris as a city had been reconstructed pretty massively over the previous couple of decades in ways that the elites hoped would preclude the pattern of insurrections that was in some degree endemic in Parisian life in the 19th century. But in any case, this, to some extent, new working class in Paris suddenly found itself in control of its own destiny and organized to try to remake the city in ways that would allow for, one, more democratic participation, and two, a more egalitarian economy in which the rights and interests of workers would be protected. And so briefly, and it was really very brief, from kind of the middle of March 1871 until the later days of May that same year, Paris was governed by a popular government and of its choosing, of workers' choosing. And it really became, in the aftermath of its destruction, a kind of symbol, a very powerful symbol of what workers could do if given the opportunity or if they seized the opportunity to claim the right to govern themselves. And so although in the end, literally tens of thousands of communards were slaughtered by the national French government that sought to reclaim its governance over Paris, and the commune itself collapsed, it remained a kind of iconic symbol. And that symbol literally lasted for decades as workers in other settings who began to think about how they might be able to govern their own urban space look back to the commune as a moment in which that possibility had seemed to be achieved.
Can you describe the social and political circumstances that reigned in the late 19th century, obviously the Paris Commune being one part, but in the latter decades of the 19th century, what were the circumstances which provided fertile ground for the rise of municipal socialism?
You know, one would have to look at a couple of things, obviously. One would be the deteriorating social conditions of these burgeoning cities whose economic expansion and growth was driven by an ongoing process of industrialization that was kind of remaking urban economies in powerful ways and also concentrating population in cities in ever larger numbers, to an extent that the existing urban infrastructure was unable and incapable of accommodating. And so the conditions in cities that workers increasingly faced were a powerful motivation to mobilize politically. So that's one factor. And you know, if we had time and space, there are some very colorful descriptions of conditions of urban life in this period, in the 1880s, 1890s, even early 20th century, that really drove workers to desperation, in a sense, to find a way to improve their life circumstances. But the late 19th century globally was also a period of kind of economic instability. And so there were, and it was a byproduct in large degree of this very rapid expansion of economies. So there was a period, and it was particularly pronounced in the US, but it was also true in other places as well, of economic depression. That was kind of a roller coaster. In the 1870s, a major depression. In the 1880s, a briefer but still deep depression, and then a disastrous depression in the 1890s that was worldwide in scope. And those depression conditions only accentuated the depths of hardship that workers were facing in their cities. These conditions spawned a rash of mass strikes that swept around the world in many ways. They weren't directly interconnected, but there was certainly an awareness of workers mobilizing directly at the workplace to try to change their conditions. So there were the famous railroad strikes in the United States in 1877, 1886, 1894, but in between as well, where the powers of government were mobilized to try to crush these strikes. And in some cases, where the strikes had a specific urban cast to them, as it did, for instance, in Bradford in 1890 with the Manningham Mills textile strike, local governments became kind of complicit in the suppression of this strike activity. And so in some ways, quite naturally, quite organically, workers had to ask themselves, you know, how do we prevent local government from being this instrument of repression that is not only not addressing our material needs in terms of life, daily life, but also is crushing our efforts to mobilize at the workplace. And so there's quite a pattern, you know, and it's worldwide. It's in Australia in the docks. It's in Australia in the sheep shearing beds. It's on the railroads. It's in textile mills. Out of these conflicts emerges a turn toward politics, which has a distinctly local dimension to it. And this really is where, in many ways, I think municipal socialism is born. There had certainly been prior efforts to try to win control of city government, but there's a distinctly you know, powerful movement in this direction in the 1890s that begins to take shape. Now, it's hemmed in by the existing control that elites generally had of municipal government. One of the most important features of which was the restrictive municipal franchise, that is the right to vote in city elections. And this was really, again, a worldwide phenomenon, even where workers, as they did in Germany and other countries, won the parliamentary franchise, won the ability to participate in national elections. Municipal franchise restriction remained in place so that workers were, to a very large extent, shut out of an ability to insert themselves into local politics. And so challenging the very basic right to vote became a part and parcel of these municipal socialist efforts in the 1890s and going forward. And it really wasn't until the aftermath of World War I, that the municipal right to vote became essentially a kind of general franchise. That is, and to a large extent, women also in the United States, but also elsewhere, previously had won the right to participate in municipal campaigns. So it's a kind of this moment in the 1890s, and I talk about it as a moment. It's really over a period of years, but it's a moment of new kind of experimentation with a politics that's very local and that has very tangible and immediate kind of demands beyond just the franchise, for better housing, for, you know, the right of municipal workers to unionize, for, you know, things as basic as municipally owned bathhouses, because in most housing, workers didn't have bathing facilities. And so the right to have a public bath facility became a kind of central demand. Enhanced public schools and education, libraries, and, you know, a whole raft of municipal services that we take for granted now were only in people's imagination at that point, and something that they desired to achieve.
I'm speaking with historian Shelton Stromquist about his book, Claiming the City, A Global History of Workers' Fight for Municipal Socialism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, as you illustrate in Claiming the City, there was great variation between different struggles in different cities around the world. I wonder if you can tell us about the importance of the fight for public space, including for agitating and being able to use in working class struggles in the struggle for socialism.
Certainly, and the right to public space was integral to all of these struggles. And one of the things that I would want to point out is that there's a remarkable congruence between the demands of workers in one city, in one country, and those in others, other places. And at times, one or another issue took prominence, but the fight for public space was always there. It took a variety of forms. Public parks, to the extent that they existed in these rapidly growing cities, were largely treated as elite reserves. That is, quiet places where local elites could enjoy themselves and enjoy the outdoors, but where they wouldn't be bothered by workers or their children carousing around or playing ball or doing whatever their fancy might lead them to do. And so in many cities, workers sought to kind of reclaim those parks as space that they had a right to, and a right to practice their own kind of cultural life as they saw fit. But parks were also a place where people could gather in large numbers to hear a public speech or to even mobilize politically to try to assert their rights or make demands. And this, of course, was treated by the elite as a great violation of their conception of how public space ought to be treated. So there are numbers of examples, but one of the most dramatic is in Bradford, England. A park called Bogart Hole that became the center of agitation for a period of months, even years, around these very issues. And when authorities tried to regulate that space, to prohibit public gatherings or to push people out of that space in ways that would retain its pristine character, workers fought back. And so there was an ongoing struggle for Bogart Hole that really saw the mobilization of literally tens of thousands of workers, and some of the most prominent speakers in the British Independent Labour Party came to join in the struggle and to assert the right to free speech. And in the end, they won, at least a partial victory. Although still regulated, became a space where workers could gather. So that notion of public space is crucial. But one other thing that I would mention in this conjunction is that city councils, governing bodies that were dominated by the elite, because they controlled the franchise and workers found it very hard to get themselves elected or their parties to be represented in city councils. City councils were a kind of reserve in their own right, where meetings were held during the day when elite members of the local community could readily gather, leave their business interests aside, and conduct the business of the city. But of course, in those cases where workers were able to be elected to city councils, that city council public space, if you will, had to be regulated in ways that allowed for their participation. And that meant, for instance, having meetings at night when workers were not working and where they could actually represent the interests of their community. And there was across countries and across communities, a knockdown, drag-out fight over just the simple thing of when a city council might meet to conduct the city's business. Again, as workers fought their way into city councils through hard-fought elections in small numbers initially, this was one of the first things they fought for, was to open up city councils as public space where workers and their interests could be better represented.
Can you tell us about some of the more robust experiments in municipal socialism in the United States? What stands out in particular?
The case that leaps immediately to mind whenever we talk about municipal socialism in the United States is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But I would before talking about Milwaukee, I would want to say that Milwaukee is in many ways the tip of the iceberg. It's a very prominent tip, but literally by 1910, 1911, 1912, workers were winning elections in the United States to city councils and even winning control over the governance of cities in increasing numbers. And so there were literally in Ohio, of all places, in terms of today's politics, there were, 30 some cities in 1911 that were governed by socialists. Some of them small, but some of them quite prominent. But there were, of course, examples that had a kind of more enduring presence, but also a more complete kind of example of what socialist governance in a city might look like. And Milwaukee was, of course, one. The Milwaukee story really, in many ways, begins in the 1890s when a fairly strong urban populist movement developed and began to address, sort of day-to-day grievances that workers faced in the city. The populists, ultimately succumbed to a kind of fusion with the Democratic Party in 1896, and sort of the ground was cut from under that movement. But by the very early 20th century, literally by 1900, a new socialist party was emerging that began to run candidates for local office in Milwaukee and elsewhere. And in Milwaukee, the initial success was not great. I mean, there were a couple of socialists elected to a 45-member city council in 1902. By 1904, the vote seemed to have stagnated, but by the next local election, nine city councilors, called aldermen in Milwaukee, were elected. And that core group of nine socialists then began to push very hard for a whole range of demands that included some of what we've talked about, but also public ownership of of electricity and of water and of other basic utilities. But the real breakthrough for Milwaukee came in 1910, when the socialists not only won a majority in the city council, but elected a mayor, and were in a position then to really kind of push forward their program in a comprehensive way. They also won control of the county board and elected in the fall of 1910, Victor Berger, the leading socialist in the city, to Congress, one of the few socialists who won national office. And so the socialists governed for 2 years, and it was in the subsequent election then that they lost power. And they lost power as a result, as was typical in many of these cases, to what was called fusion, where the Democrats and Republicans, the dominant parties traditionally, found that they had more common ground than they had differences, at least in the short term, and would align themselves together on around a single candidate in order to push out or to thwart any success that the socialists might have. And indeed, in Milwaukee, as in so many places where this happened, that proved to be successful. And so for a period of about 4 years, the socialists were out of office, at least in terms of total control. They still had city council representation. But then in 1916, they won control again. And on and off, really, for the next 40 years, the socialists were a powerful political force in Milwaukee, including from 1948 to 1960, when a man named Frank Zeidler won and held the mayoral office in Milwaukee in the post-World War II period when, you know, this wasn't happening elsewhere. But the United States is not an outlier, shall we say, in terms of the success that socialists had at the municipal level in this earlier period. And Milwaukee stands as a leading example, but there were certainly others.
I'm speaking with Shelton Stromquist about his book, Claiming the City, A Global History of Workers' Fight for Municipal Socialism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So how did a municipal socialist see their relationship to the larger strategies of reform or revolution, to widespread socialist transformation? Did they see their cities as hubs that could expand? Did they see this as a provisional step? Was it an end in itself? How did they understand it?
I think for most municipal socialists, and here I'm talking about the phenomenon, not just in the United States, but worldwide, for many of them, the idea of transformation on a larger scale, on a national scale, was certainly something that they held close in an aspirational sense. But they saw the city as a place to begin, as a place to carve out space in which workers could demonstrate their capacity to govern, could improve the conditions of daily life in dramatic ways, and could serve as a kind of staging ground for a broader transformation of their societies and economies along collectivist lines. But I don't want to underestimate the extent to which these municipal socialists really saw the city as their primary arena of action. And of course, there was a big debate in the socialist movement about how much priority to give such municipal politics. I mean, in the United States, municipal socialists were sometimes referred to by their opponents within the socialist movement as so-called sewer socialists. This was a kind of demeaning term, as if, they're not really dealing with important things. They're just dealing with sewers. But of course, sewers were pretty important in these cities where public sanitation was in such horrendous shape, and where even the access to pure water and let alone decent housing was not available to most. So in spite of this debate, and there is a real tension in the movement between the municipalists and their their counterparts who saw revolution as a kind of as a total transformative kind of objective, and that anything short of that was really just kind of reformist and was kind of working on the margins without really accomplishing any great change. There was a big debate at the founding of the Socialist Party of America in 1901 over whether to have something called immediate demands. And the revolutionists in the party said, no, you know, you can't do this on a piecemeal basis. You have to have kind of total transformation by revolutionary means as the only objective. And there's no point in having sort of piecemeal efforts. And one of the opponents of that view, one of the municipal socialists at one point in the debate said, well, you know, it's sort of like they want to say they're part of a shipwrecked crew offshore, and they want to say, we're going to get to shore. And that's the only thing that matters. We're going to get to shore. Their opponents, the so-called municipal socialists, said, no, we're going to get to shore, but we're going to get to shore by bailing the boat and, you know, paddling the boat steadily to get there. And the whole point was that, you know, that these municipalists really understood or believed that the way to socialist transformation was through concrete reforms that had a socialist character. And that once you began to build that strength at local levels, you could infuse a national movement with a kind of strength that it would otherwise lack. So this tension within a movement remained, but the municipalists really began to demonstrate in the pre-World War I period that there was something to be said for this kind of success. And they were doing it not just in one country, but in countries around the world. One of the things that I tried to stress in the book was the internationalism of these locally grounded socialists who saw their struggle as part of a worldwide campaign to make cities livable, but also to socialize cities and to socialize countries in ways that would dramatically improve the lives of workers.
Well, you just mentioned World War I, and obviously World War I couldn't be understated as a pivotal event, obviously leading to mass carnage, mass social dislocation, and out of which many people demanded a better world. I wonder if you could tell us about how those fights that had predated World War I were shaped by the war and then the aftermath, because there was a wave of revolutions that followed World War I, especially in Germany and Eastern Europe, and how that affected the shape of municipal socialism.
Right. Well, this is a big but a very important question. And it's also a question that bears on this tension between the kind of revolutionists and the municipalists that I was just talking about. As most people probably know, with the outbreak of World War I, the Second Socialist International, which had been the kind of leading global force for socialism on a national but international scale, collapsed as the national socialist movements retreated into their respective kind of national interests and found it necessary to support the war aims of their own national governments. But the war, as you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, not only produced massive carnage on the battlefield, but also tremendous hardship on the home front. And while it varied some from one country, even one city to another, the conditions of life in cities around the world that were whose nation states were involved in the war deteriorated rapidly. And so there were a set of conditions that somebody needed to address. And And municipal socialists, were in a strong position because of their previous pre-war successes to lay claim to advocacy for the needs of workers in this very difficult time. And so they fought for better access to food. They fought against rising prices. They fought for improved wages to try to meet the needs of distressed families. They fought for expanded public welfare, especially for the families of soldiers who had gone off to war, but for the general population as well. These local economies were dislocated and in great need of improvement, even more so during the war than before. And so the socialists were well positioned to become advocates for those needs of workers in cities. The war provided a kind of cover. And in many cases, they had to be kind of ostensibly neutral or pro-war in their public posture. But in fact, at the grassroots level, they were working very hard to build coalitions that could strengthen them politically. And they were looking toward the end of the war as a moment when new political opportunities would unfold, and particularly where the right to the franchise would be expanded. And so, it's about a third of my book really deals with the war period. And there's dramatic stories from one country to another of the way in which these local efforts unfolded. But as you alluded to, by the end of the war, with the German Reich essentially collapsed, with the Austrian monarchy in shambles, and with other countries sort of reeling from the effects of the war in ways that seemed to open or reopen new political space for workers, a period of democratic promise was in the air, and it took hold very powerfully. I might say that in Australia, for instance, one of the ancillary but very important campaigns that reinforced a kind of anti-war posture on the part of a lot of working people was the campaigns to defeat conscription. And in two referenda in 1917 and 1918, the Australian public and particularly working class voted down conscription and implicitly also voted down, at least to a degree, support for the war itself. And so this kind of mobilization, and it was happening in Germany through the independent Social Democratic Party that emerged in 1917-18, it happened elsewhere. This kind of new politics of wartime translated into the promise of a new politics in the post-war period. And so in Germany, with the collapse of national government, in November of 1918, with the end of the war, workers and soldiers mobilized at the municipal level to form new councils that aspired to govern their communities. And these workers and soldiers councils, this council movement, became for a period of time a very powerful political force, particularly at the local level. In Austria, the collapse of central authority also enabled workers in municipalities, foremost in Vienna, to assert their political rights. And in the case of Vienna, to elect a socialist majority to the city council.
I'm speaking with the author of Claiming the City, A Global History of Workers' Fight for Municipal Socialism. Shelton Stromquist is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in the aftermath of World War I, if, the Paris Commune stands out as the inspiration for urban revolution, Red Vienna is often seen as the pinnacle of experiments in remaking a city on socialist lines. Can you tell us what Red Vienna was and how did it come to be coming out of World War I?
Sure. And it really is an important moment that had worldwide significance. But as with other cities around the world, it's important to recognize that in Vienna, municipal socialists had been quite active in the trenches, so to speak, of the pre-war political period. So that they had elected a few city councilors to the city council in Vienna in the pre-war period, and those city councilors had established themselves as, you know, kind of recognized local political leaders who advocated a kind of program of municipal reform very similar to what socialists around the world were advocating. So at the end of the war, the Austrian economy was in total collapse. A process of political reconstitution at the national level led to a rewriting of the constitution in ways that gave to Vienna the status of a province, not just as a city, but the city itself became a province. That was important because it enabled the city then to exercise a certain amount of tax authority that as a city under the existing constitution it would not have been able to do. And this in the end proved quite critical. But this municipal socialist movement then took hold through the election of May 1919 of a municipal government. Mayor of Vienna was a former woodturner, manual worker, named Jakob Reumann, who had served in city council, as I said, for many, many terms, along with a number of others. And in the kind of excruciatingly difficult circumstances that they faced at the end of the war, they set about trying to rebuild the economy of Vienna along socialist lines. The greatest and most pressing need that Vienna workers faced was the need for housing. And it had been a private housing market before and during the war. Rents had escalated. Housing was increasingly difficult to come by. And so this new socialist municipality, with the power to tax, set about building housing for workers on a scale that had never been seen before, not just in Vienna, but really anywhere around the world. And over the course of the next 12, 13 years, some 65,000 new units of housing were built. Some of them in quite, most of them, in fact, in quite large and very appealing housing complexes. That provided for workers a degree of comfort that they had never had before in the private housing market. But they also built public baths. They provided social welfare to meet the needs, the day-to-day needs of the poorest workers. They kind of opened up the public space in the city in ways that it had not been before. And so over the course of time, Vienna really became a kind of city on a hill, if you will, of a kind of place where socialists could and in fact did demonstrate the power of their ideas in practice. One of the most interesting things that I came across was the extent to which the local elite were just in disbelief at the new kind of taxation that they were going to be subject to in order to finance the transformation of this city. And the Australian Worker, a working class newspaper in Australia, not in Austria, published an account in 1925, so well into the socialist reconstruction of Vienna, in which they wrote, "The socialist most hated in Vienna by the well-to-do is certainly Hugo Breitner. Speak to them of Lenin, Trotsky, or Liebknecht, and they will listen with perfect calm. But mention the name Breitner, and the calm is replaced by fury and hate. He is credited with the intention of destroying the whole economic life of Vienna. In reality, he is merely the author of the financial policy of the Municipal Council. Breitner's new tax scheme introduced some 18 new taxes, which chiefly hit those who can afford to pay, and abolishes one or two old taxes, which burdened the workers unfairly. So there is a sense in which this kind of new order of things in Vienna is really not just a political attack on the traditional governance by ruling elites, but on the kind of economic and property interests that those elites have, and that becomes then a source for financing this reconstruction of the city, which lasts until 1934, when it is crushed by Nazi sympathizers and disappears. But interestingly enough, not too long ago, I guess it was in May of this year, the New York Times Magazine published a very interesting account of housing in Vienna. And the legacy of this Red Vienna period is very much alive, still in Vienna, where 60-some percent of the population lives in public housing, and rents are controlled so that no one, regardless of income, pays more than 8% of their income for rent. And this is in housing that is really quite, not just respectable, but really quite fine in terms of the conditions of life, daily life. So Red Vienna became a symbol, like the Paris Commune, of what socialists might do if they won political power. And it resonated around the world. I mean, it was literally talked about in labor and socialist papers from one end of the globe to another as a kind of leading example of what municipal socialism might mean.
Well, Shelton, I'll end on this question. Right now seems, you know, very removed from such times, the times of Red Vienna. In fact, feels like a period of, you know, retrenchment, certainly for the left. I wonder if you, obviously you're a historian, but when you look at the experience of municipal socialism, the kind of conditions under which people fought for municipal socialism, do you think that this is a moment where such struggles that are focused on local battles could be revived, or are conditions very different? I mean, obviously, it's a different world, but are there any commonalities between those struggles, the times that they've struggled in then and now?
Yeah, no, one of the reasons I got into this project in the first place was a sense that there is a kind of relevance to this history for the current times that I think we need to be cognizant of. And several things that briefly I would mention. One is that I think to a large extent, we fail to recognize the extent to which the transformative effect of these municipal socialist reforms at the city level remain with us today. Because I do think that that cities remain a kind of arena of possibility and even realization of a kind of institutional fabric that can meet the needs of working people in very concrete ways. I mean, there are many ways in which we still are living in socialist cities. You know, most cities have public water and public sewerage. Many cities have public electricity. Many, and if not most cities, have public transit, not private streetcars of the old days, but publicly owned transit companies. The fabric of daily life in cities is regulated and is empowered, you know, to a very degree by the kinds of things that municipal socialists in this early period were fighting for. So I think we should not underestimate the extent to which we inherit, in a way, the fruits of their struggles and live in cities which are public spaces. Now, the question is, can we keep them? And that's where the challenge of the moment very much comes into play. You know, there's a tremendous pressure to try to undo this public fabric in a lot of ways, to use state power to disempower cities from doing what they might otherwise do. So the question of home rule and the ability of cities to continue to govern themselves, which was a longstanding demand, and the fruits of which are quite uneven. There are some states, like my own, where in Iowa, where the state essentially regulates with a heavy hand what cities can do. But there are other cities in which there's a much more open space. So I think, you know, this new municipalist movement, which is alive and well, and, you know, I think of Richmond, California, right in your backyard, as an example of what progressives can do at a city level to not only maintain, but to build on this tradition. But, you know, the fight for the rights to collective bargaining of public sector workers is such a fundamental struggle in our own time. And again, nowhere more than in my own state. And the right of public workers to unionize and to have adequate wages and hours and working conditions was something the municipal socialists fought and won to a large degree. But that really remains very much under duress. So the attempt to privatize the city, to create it again as a reserve for elite interests and property holding interests, is a battle that's ongoing and one that I think we need to fight. But I do think cities offer an opportunity because they still are fundamentally working class spaces. And to the extent that workers can mobilize around these interests, both protecting what we have, but building on it as well, I think there's opportunity. And again, I think that local politics can translate into a more vibrant national politics. But cities are a good place to begin. And I think there's opportunity there.
Sheldon Stromquist, thank you so much.
Happy to join you.
Sheldon Stromquist has been my guest. He is the author of Claiming the City, A Global History of Workers' Fight for Municipal Socialism. You can find a link to that on againstthegrain.org. He's Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Iowa, author of many books, including Labor's Cold War. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. We want to thank all of you who pledged during our holiday fund drive. You can still pledge until December 31st at kpfa.org. Your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. Thanks for keeping KPFA alive and thriving.